Blog Talk Radio.
Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains against chronic disease. Thousands die yearly due to drug reactions. What can be done? Thomas Edison is quoted as declaring, "The doctor of the future will give no medicine, but interest his patients in diet and nutrition, exercise, and the care of the human frame. He will teach them about the cause of all disease. The doctors of the future are here." Welcome to Blue Zone Wellness with your host, Keith Henry, ND, one of the doctors of the future.
Hi, welcome to Blue Zone Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. Thank you for joining me here on this beautiful, beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm broadcasting from right outside of Orlando, Florida. If you've listened before, as you know, I'm a traditionally trained naturopath with a practice and ministry located in Orlando, Florida. And I approach natural medicine or alternative medicine from a Christian perspective. Every Sunday afternoon, be sure to join me right here on Blue Zone Wellness from 4 to 5 p.m. as we discuss insights into natural medicine and alternative therapies. Again, thank you for joining me. We have an exciting and very interesting and insightful show for you today. But before we get started, let me go ahead and just give you some information to be able to contact me or to follow me or to stay up on a lot of natural health information. First, you can friend me at Facebook. You can find me at Facebook and send me a friend request at facebook.com/naturedoc. Or you can go to Twitter and it's at Blue Zone Wellness. You can follow me on Twitter and catch all of my updates when we post to our blog new articles about natural remedies, alternative medicine. You can read there from Phase 3 Ministries as well as from Blue Zone Wellness. You can also follow me here at blogtalkradio.com/Blue Zone Wellness. You can follow me there, and whenever we have a show coming up, of course, you will receive an automatic email whether or not you're interested in the show, or if you can't catch it right then, you can come back later and catch it, but you'll have an email letting you know the topic of the show that day, and you can decide whether or not then it can be sent directly to your inbox, your email, etc. I just want to remind you, if you like looking and reading a lot of natural health information, you will find a lot at my blog at phase3ministries.com/WordPress. That's phase, P-H-A-S-E, the number 3, ministries.com/WordPress. Now, today in our show, we have a very interesting show. We're going to be talking about the flu. If you've been watching the news, you know that the news is telling us that this year, they are receiving what appears to be an epidemic, or maybe not epidemic proportions, but the flu rates are higher than they've been in previous years, according to most of the news reports. And we're going to talk about one of my favorite herbs to protect you from the flu. It is a very effective herb, and I'll also tell you one or two other things you can combine with it. But it's far better to be able to prevent disease than to know how to treat it after it's already been contracted. We're going to be talking about that starting this segment off. We are in the Weekend Natural News Review. If this is your first time listening, in this first segment, we talk about news articles that have come out during the week, during the past week, that we think are interesting and insightful, and we talk about them and analyze them. Again, if you're listening during the show, if you would like to call in, you can do so at 917-889-2207. That's 917-889-2207. Also, we'll be talking about colloidal silver and an article based upon colloidal silver as a natural antibiotic, which you can buy. It's rather expensive, or there are also ways that you can make it yourself. It's very, very effective. And in this first segment, we'll also be talking about why you should avoid surgery at certain times if you necessarily have to get surgery. Of course, it's best to stay out of hospitals, and we will be talking about why and some of the reasons why it's best to stay out of hospitals. But if you must just have surgery, there's some studies that show some of the best times to have it if you have to have it. Now, we're going to take a quick break, about a minute break, and we're going to come back, and we are going to get right into our show. We're going to get to our first segment, so that we can go into our second segment, which we'll be talking about squash, the benefits of squash, the health benefits of squash. And then our last and final segment today, we'll be talking about the benefits of vitamin A as opposed to beta carotene, and how, what's the benefit of them both, and how to recognize deficiencies and the amounts that you need to stay healthy. You're listening to Blue Zone Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We'll be right back after these brief messages.
How do you feel? No, really. How do you feel? Do you feel lively? Are you bursting with energy? Or do you feel run down and suffer from a lack of energy most of the time? Have frequent colds, aches and pains of one sort or another? The fact of the matter is that most people in America are not well. But you can begin to change all of that today by simply visiting the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog of Keith Henry, ND, at www.phase3ministries.com/WordPress. Go there now and explore the wealth of amazing wellness information. That's www.phase3ministries.com/WordPress, the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog.
You are listening to Blue Zone Wellness with Dr. Keith Henry on BlueZoneWellness.org. Be sure to join us here every week at the same time. You can also listen at blogtalkradio.com/BlueZoneWellness. There you can also download the app and listen to the archived versions on your smartphone. So from Blue Zone Wellness, here's to your health.
Welcome back to Blue Zone Wellness. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Dr. Keith. And also, welcome again, my friends from Costa Rica that are listening, and not only from Costa Rica, but from wherever you may be listening, all around the world, especially here in Orlando, Florida area. And we're going to go ahead and get started with our first article. Again, we take, in this first segment, we take articles from that deals with natural remedies and natural health, and we talk about, analyze, and discuss them. This article caught my attention because I used this particular herb we're going to discuss here in my practice. I've used it personally. And it's okay, we're back. We had a bit of technical difficulties there. As I was saying, this article I found was very interesting to me, this first article, because I have actually used this particular herb myself in practice a lot, and I've also used it personally. And this particular herb that we're going to be talking about here is called black elderberry. And sometimes you will see it in the stores in the form of a syrup called Sambuca, which is a concentrated form of the herb. You can take it in that fashion, or you can take the herbs themselves and you can make it as a tea and you can consume it. And it's very, very effective. The article points out, talking about how black elderberry has been known throughout the ages as a potent immune booster, tackling colds and influenza, heart disease, and even cancer. And the author of the article says it's used for centuries as a folk remedy in North America, in Europe, in Asia, and in North Africa. And not only that, modern science has begun to take notice of the exceptional healing properties of this berry. And the author points out that it's jam-packed with organic pigments, flavonoids, vitamins, and minerals, and that elderberry is an excellent addition to any herbal medicine chest. And this article was taken from naturalnews.com. And the author goes on to point out further in this particular article, to basically give a little bit more background of the article, talking about how it was traditionally used as in wines and other medicinal extracts as a preservative. But the author also points out that only ripe cooked berries and the flowers are used for preparation, since the stems, the leaves, and the unripe berries contains poisonous levels of cyanide glucosides. Not only that, elderberry, though, is rich in one of the vitamins that we're going to be talking about today. It's rich in vitamin A. It's rich in vitamin C. It's also rich in calcium, iron, vitamin B6, as well as the flavonoid quercetin, which also is responsible, these various elements and nutrients are partly responsible for how effective it is against the flu and cold as well. Now, Hippocrates held elderberry as a very prominent healing plant, while the Native Americans used it for sciatica. They also used it for coughs and rheumatism, along with other ailments and injuries of the skin. Usually, anytime the Native Americans or the Indians used an herb, you could pretty much bet that the herb is very, very effective. Hippocrates, the father of medicine, also used it, considered the father of medicine. And essentially, he was not what we would call an allopathic doctor, allopathic physician. He was actually what we would call a natural doctor or a natural physician. So elderberry, as this article pointed out, also is very, very effective. And I'm just going to get here, as the article does, talk a little bit about some of the science behind it. The author goes on to point out that it's famous for its capacity to prevent and treat upper respiratory infections and fever. And it is actually a top-notch medicinal herb, and that it is. And then the author is quoting Israeli researcher Dr. Madeline Mamagulu of Hadassah Hebrew University Medical Center. And the article points out how he has made it a life mission to study the healing, or she has made it a life mission to study the healing properties of elderberry. And she found 20% of individuals suffering from the flu had significant relief after taking elderberry within 24 hours when the elderberry extract was consumed. So in her studies, over the past 20 years, she's found that 20% of people who have taken it had significant relief within 24 hours when the elderberry extract was consumed. The sore throat, the coughing, the fever, and the muscle aches were all reduced. The article goes on to point out further that 73% felt better based upon her studies after the second day. Within 3 days, 90% were completely cured. And the article goes on to compare this with the usual week or so it takes with the average person to recover from the flu without intervention. So here we have a herb, elderberry specifically, and when people, from this particular, from her studies, when people take elderberry for the flu, she found that within 24 hours, 20% of them obtained significant relief from sore throat, coughing, fever, and muscle aches. 73% felt better after the second day, that's basically 48 hours, and within 72 hours, a full 90% were completely cured or healed. Now, normally, ordinarily, when you have the flu, you could be down for a week, 2 weeks. I've seen people down for 3 weeks with some parts of some symptoms of the flu. And here we have this herb, elderberry, when taken the way constructed, usually in an extract, which is typically you can take the herbal extract in a liquid or the capsules, or you can drink the tea. If I was taking the tea made from the flowers, I would take, or the berries, I would take probably 3 to 4 cups per day, but I wouldn't just take elderberry by itself if I was coming down with the flu. I would be very, very aggressive. I would take a berry. It would be probably the chief constituent of what I would be doing, but I would also take high dosages of vitamin C, anywhere from 15 to 20,000 units in its early acute phases. I would do a hot foot bath as well. I would also take echinacea, golden seal, and I would also take grapefruit seed extract, and I would put these in liquid, and I would drop grapefruit seed extract into this water. I would take a glass of warm water, and I would squeeze fresh lemon juice in there, and I would follow the directions on the extract of golden seal, also of echinacea, and I would take the high dose of vitamin C, and I would take this elderberry, and usually, also I would take colloidal silver, which we're going to talk about next in this segment. And in most cases, a very aggressive program like that will actually prevent, will keep you from suffering During the first symptoms of the flu and they're setting in, if you follow a similar pattern of doing these things, I've been able to knock the flu out within less than a 24-hour period by following a similar pattern. Now, if you were drinking that again, let me back up just in the event you didn't get that. I would go on the elderberry extract. You can either buy the tea itself and drink it. I would probably drink it throughout the day when I first begin to get the symptoms. If you work and you don't have an opportunity to be able to make the tea, you can buy Sambuca in most health food stores, which is a concentrated syrup form. It's almost like a cough syrup, and it's basically a concentrate or extract of elderberry. It's very effective. I would take either that if I wasn't going to take the tea, or I would take the liquid extract, and I would put that in warm water and take that probably 3 to 4 times a day. Or I would take the extract in the capsule form. Combined with that, then every 30 minutes to an hour, in between those times, I would take about 8 ounce glass of warm water. I would squeeze the juice of a fresh lemon in there at the first symptoms. I would put grapefruit seed extract, a few drops of grapefruit extract in that water. I would put a pinch of cayenne pepper. Golden seal extract, a few drops of that in that water, echinacea extracts in that water, and I would drink that. Now, in every hour or so, I would continue to drink the water without adding all those other extracts. So, for instance, let me back up and explain how I would do this. Say, for instance, I was going to start at 5 in the afternoon. I would take the warm water, the lemon juice, and the cayenne pepper, and I would begin to drink it with all of those extracts and herbs that I mentioned. After about an hour, I would take that again, but I wouldn't include all of the various herbs at that time. It would be too soon to take all of them again. But I would just include in that warm water. I would take the warm water and the lemon juice and a pinch of cayenne pepper. And then maybe 3 or 4 hours later, when I'm taking that water again, I would add those herbs again. I would also, the amount of vitamin C I would add with bioflavonoids, I would add during that day probably between 12 to 15,000 milligrams at least. And if you do that, in most cases, you're going to be able to, when you first begin to get the symptoms of that flu or that cold, you'll be able to knock it out. And also when you involve the amount or include the amount of elderberry, which we've been talking about as well. This article also went on to say further that additionally, a British in vitro study found that black elderberry extract was over 99% effective in combating avian bird flu, H5N1. And in Panama, elderberry juice was successfully used to treat the 1995 flu epidemic. So you have one in vitro study from Britain, and then you have the flu epidemic that broke out in 1995 in Panama, and elderberry was used to effectively treat, used effectively in each of these cases. The article points out further, elderberry also enhances the immune system. And they quote a scientist from a research center in Germany found that high levels of anthocyanins in elderberry improve immune function by boosting cytokine production. And these proteins, these cytokines, they act as messengers within the immune system, helping to regulate the immune response. And for those contending, the article says, with HIV or a suppressed immune system, this is promising news. Finally, the last part of the article, the author says, not only effective for infectious disease, elderberry supports cardiovascular health and mitigates cancer as well. And then she quotes, or the author quotes, the University of Graz in Austria, and she points out how they discovered that elderberry extract diminished the oxidation of low-density lipoprotein, or LDL, which is considered the bad cholesterol. And went on to point out that since oxidation of LDL cholesterol contributes to arteriosclerosis, elderberry is a powerful medicine against heart disease, says the article. And then the author points out in how elderberry affects or how it's used also in helping stunt tumor growth. She says it is exceptional in stunning tumor growth because it hinders the formation of unwanted blood vessels and it's also antioxidant. And also says, quote, research has shown that elderberry, when combined with other anthocyanin-rich berries, curbs cellular mutations and tumor growth. In clinical studies, the berry extract decreased tumor growth by more than 50%. So here you have elderberry is a very, very potent herb that the Creator has given us. And I would highly suggest that you have it handy. If you don't have it handy, that you get some and have it handy, especially seeing as how we're in the season, the flu season, and so many people are having the flu, and so many people are going to get the flu shots that I personally do not recommend. But an even stronger position with respect to the flu is to stay healthy overall. Because if your immune system is strong, if you're up to par, if you're healthy, your well-being overall, it is virtually impossible for you to get sick. But you're only going to get sick with the COVID or flu when your immune system has been compromised. And when that happens, then you will have to, it's good to have these things on hand and to be able to fight off, to help your body to fight off any of these diseases. We're going to go ahead and move right into our next article, in which discusses it really could have been part of the first article to a degree, but this article is entitled 10 Ways to Use Colloidal Silver's Amazing Healing Abilities. This is another nutrient or constituent that I've used in my practice and I've used personally to help the body. It aids as a natural antibiotic. And in this particular article, 10 Ways to Use Colloidal Silver's Amazing Healing Abilities is also taken from naturalnews.com. The author starts off by telling us that colloidal silver consists of silver atoms suspended in distilled ionless water, and the particles of silver are small enough to penetrate on a cellular level and destroy pathogens of all types, including bacteria, fungal spores, parasites, and viruses. So basically, it's colloidal silver. It's made in such a way that the small particles of silver are able to pass through the walls of the cells, because remember, we live or die on the cellular level. And I said this before, you have to understand when you're looking at disease, when you're looking at sickness, the health or lack thereof of the cells is the health or lack thereof of the body. Because remember, we start off with the cells, which make up the tissues, and the tissues make up the organs, and the organs make up the body, and the body is made up of systems, and so everything goes back to the cellular level. So the article points out further, not only does silver get rid of pathogens, it helps promote rapid healing of the tissues infected or destroyed. Most burn centers, the article points out, use various forms of silver and silver-soaked bandaging for burn victims. And it goes on to point out how you can buy devices to actually make your own silver. And the article points out it has no adverse side effects. It leaves beneficial bacteria intact, and reports of skin turning blue are greatly exaggerated. And this is one of the side effects, quote side effects, that those who are opposed to natural medicine would tout, that those who have taken silver, or their skin would turn blue if used excessively. And it is true, if you use the wrong type of silver. Because there were some people making it at home and not fully educated, but even those, it would take, for most of those cases, it took years and years of taking it excessively to have that occur. And even though it's a harmless condition, it turns the skin blue. Again, it's like when you hear that a particular herb is dangerous or toxic. What they typically leave out is the significant amounts of the herbs that you would have to take in general to have negative side effects. Or they may leave out that the person who was sick was on some type of medication and was taking the herbs or whatever it was without proper education or without consulting with a herbalist or a naturopathic doctor or a medical doctor who practices natural medicine to get an idea of whether or not they could, or even asking their medical doctor whether or not it was safe to mix these herbs with whatever drug they were taking. So there's always, you have to get the entire story to find out, okay, what caused the side effect? What caused the negative reaction? But generally speaking, the colloidal silver is very, very safe. And you have to take enormous amounts for long amounts of time to have any negative side effects, more amounts than most people would take in a and especially in any one sitting. As this article points out further, under 10 ways to use colloidal silver for self-healing, and the author points out that you can spray it onto burns to prevent infections and promote faster healing without scarring. You can also spray or dab it into ringworm, boils, herpes sores, and warts to help cause them to heal faster. The article points out also, if you're having bronchial problems or walking pneumonia, you can put some colloidal silver in a nebulizer and breathe it into your bronchial area and lungs directly. Small amounts taken daily as a tonic would give what some call a second immune system to guard against flus and colds. And I personally probably wouldn't recommend, not that it would do any harm to take it in small amounts, but I would advocate eating a healthy diet of fresh fruits and vegetables, exercising, drinking plenty of water, getting a good lot of rest. These things would generally not worrying and trusting in the Creator, but that goes back to those laws of health that we say on here is the very foundation of wellness and healing. Number one is trusting the Creator. Number two is sunshine. Number three is exercise, then water, then air, then rest, then diet, then self-control or temperance. Following these laws of health and following them consistently is the thing that will help us stay healthy. And there's nothing wrong if you want, to take some herbs or whatever, if you feel you're not getting all of the nutrients that you should be getting in our food because you can't afford to buy organic and the way that they're farming now and all of the chemicals they're putting in the food and snatching the nutrients out. So I'm not saying that I'm against using herbs and nutrients. I'm just saying that some of these things, if you're taking them over a long period of time, can be expensive. And it's best that not everyone is on the same level financially. So we have to be able to reach those who can afford it as well as those who can't as much as possible. And so the article points out further that colloidal silver drops can be used for ear infections without any harmful side effects. Some use it for eye and nasal infections as well, the article says, and perhaps it can be injected annually with an enema above to help cleanse the colon. Number six reason, way that it can be used according to this article, is it can be applied topically for vaginal yeast infections or oral thrush, which is a yeast infection. And it could be also used for chronic jock itch as well. And the reason it could help these things is simply because it works as a natural antibiotic, and it destroys or kills all types of pathogens, including bacteria, fungi, spores, parasites, and viruses. And these are many of these things that we're talking about. They're caused by these pathogens. And so the article points out further, it can be taken early with the onset of a cold, flu, or bronchitis to get over it quickly without harming the beneficial bacteria, while antibiotics actually kill good and bad bacteria. I also point out that colloidal silver can be used successfully to combat MRSA infection. And MRSA, if you've ever had it, if you know anyone that has had it, is one of the toughest, most difficult infections and can potentially deadly infections. And I've been able to work with it naturally by using very, very high dosages of vitamin C and the herb burdock root. But I would also highly recommend including colloidal silver because many of the antibiotics now that they give for MRSA, they're no longer useful. And the reason being is because the bacteria have become resistant to these antibiotics. And so that's not a good thing. And they're to get into a situation to where the body becomes antibiotic resistant. And the reason that happens is that the drug antibiotics do not kill all of the bacteria. So they may go and they may kill 98 or 99% of the bacteria. That small percent that it does not kill, they become resistant to that antibiotic. And so now they become almost super pathogens. And so they come up with a different antibiotic now, but the same thing occurs, and to the extent that they don't have any antibiotics to help. And these pathogens can't do that with natural antibiotics. It doesn't work that way. And so, as this article points out, there has been some success even using colloidal silver with AIDS patients. And it adds a layer of needed additional immunity, says the article, while destroying existing pathogens. And then the article gives us just a little bit of history, which you may not be aware of. And it points out that early 20th century Western medicine used silver as a prime antibiotic and antifungal until the 1930s. And so here in America, had you been living in the early 20th century, you would have been, when you were given an antibiotic, in many cases you would have been given you'd have been given silver. And then the article points out, then antibiotics became a major source of big pharma revenue or the drug companies. And he goes on to point out, as more and more antibiotics were created, the pathogenic microbes began evolving into resistant strains to them. The health dangers imposed by antibiotics by destroying friendly gut flora needed for digestion and immunity were disregarded. That's another thing that you have to remember, too, with antibiotics. They do destroy your gut flora and your gut, your good bacteria. And this will set you up for other diseases. And many times, diseases they lay the seed for other diseases, which they're almost impossible to determine what the cause is, and you go back and forth to the doctor when really the seeds were laid in the system by some antibiotic or by some other drug. And so if you have to take drugs at any point, it's best to get off of them as soon as possible if you can, and to clean your body of those drugs and to find some alternative combined with a healthy lifestyle. You may have to be on some herb or some nutrients for a while, the minerals, whatever it is, to get your body out of an acid condition or whatever. But if at all possible, it's best to get off of drugs and get on to a wellness program where you can cleanse your body and re-energize it with the necessary nutrients that God has given us with which to function. Now we're going to go on into our third article, and we're running just a little bit behind, but we'll be okay because we had a couple of minutes of technical difficulties. But we are our third and final article in this first segment is an article dealing with from Mercola.com, and it's why you should avoid afternoon surgery. And Dr. Mercola starts off by saying, if you are scheduling a surgery, you probably put some thought of the procedure. You put some thought to the procedure itself, the surgeon who will perform the procedure, and hopefully which hospital to go to. He goes on to say, but if you didn't pay much attention to the time of day your surgery is scheduled, you could be missing out on a very simple and free, yet crucially important variable in your outcome. And then he goes on to point out and describe why. Dr. Mercola says, a study conducted by Duke University researchers found that adverse events related to surgical anesthesia were more frequent for surgeries started between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. than they were for those that begin early in the morning at 7 p.m. He pointed out further, after analyzing more than 90,000 surgeries in this Duke University study, researchers found that adverse events such as nausea, vomiting, and postoperative pain were more common in the afternoon surgeries. He says, among adverse events categorized as other, which included potentially dangerous changes in blood pressure and operating room equipment problems, along with problems related to pain medication and pain management through anesthetic techniques, the predicted probability of one occurring rose from 1% at 9 a.m. to over 4% at 4 p.m. He goes on to say further, there were other problems with afternoon surgeries too, including an increased likelihood of administrative delays, such as waiting for laboratory test results, doctors running late, transport is not being available to move patients at room, and rooms not being ready on time. All of which, he says, have the potential to ultimately increase adverse events as well. And he goes on to point out some of the other reasons that could be involved with this. He says, as for why the afternoon may prove to be a more dangerous time for surgery, there are likely several factors involved, and he cites some. These are not all of them, but he cites a few why getting surgery in the afternoon could potentially be more dangerous than getting surgery early in the morning. So number one, the circadian rhythm, which is the natural circadian rhythm, it governs our sleep and the brain activity and other bodily functions that we have. The circadian rhythm dips between 3 and 5 p.m. And this may, he points out, make it harder for healthcare professionals to stay on top of complex tasks such as administering anesthesia. He points out further, fatigue. Many healthcare workers, he says, start their days early and end their shifts right around 3 p.m. And this end of the day fatigue or simply their eagerness to get home could impact their performance on the job. He points out also Anesthesia care teams often change shifts between 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. He says this means you may end up with different people caring for you from the start to finish of your surgery. And says while essential information should be transferred between teams during the shift change, it's a prime situation for mishaps to occur. And this is so true. The least amount of things that during the surgery that have to be changed and the least amount of changes that have to be made, the better off you are. He goes on to point out further in terms of weekends and the month of July is also better off avoided. Marcola points out, he says, my personal recommendation when it comes to hospital stays, naturally, my number one suggestion, and I agree with him wholeheartedly, is to avoid hospitals unless it's absolutely an emergency and you need life-saving medical attention. He says, if you're having an elective medical procedure done, remember that this gives you greater leeway and personal choice, so you need to use it. He says that many believe that training hospitals will provide them with the latest and greatest care, but they can actually be more dangerous. And he points out, as a general rule, avoid elective surgeries and procedures during the month of July because this is when brand new residents begin their training. So here we have, just let's summarize so far what we have. Number one, if you have a choice in elective surgery, it's better to try to schedule this surgery in the morning, 7, 8 in the morning. Secondarily, it doesn't, if possible, don't schedule it in the month of July. This is when, and also stay away from training hospitals. And also he points out that in July is when brand new residents begin their training. He says further, according to a 2010 report in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, lethal medication errors consistently spike about 10% each July, particularly in teaching hospitals due to the inexperience of new residents. He says also be cautious of weekends. So also, when you're doing surgery, if at all possible, stay out of these hospitals in July. Not only stay out of these hospitals in July, but he points out if at all possible, avoid surgery and stay out of hospitals. But if you must go and if you have an elective surgery, it's best not to do it on the weekend. It's best not to do it in July. And it's best not to do it in the afternoon. Then Dr. Mercola, in this particular article, he's in this section that says every hospital stay poses a risk. He cites Dr. Andrew Saul, who is a co-author of Hospitals and Health, your ortho-molecular guide to a shorter hospital stay, which is a book available on Amazon. And he points out that he explains in his book that the lowest estimate makes hospitals one of the top 10 causes of death in the United States. And the highest estimate makes hospitals and drugs the number one cause of death in the United States. He says some of the top 10 most lethal medical mishaps are mistakes that should be extremely rare but happen with shocking regularity. And let's look at some of these things that make hospitals such a dangerous place and should only be there. You should only go there if it's a life-threatening emergency if you need surgery. Number one, preventable adverse drug reactions. He says an estimated 450,000 preventable medication-related adverse events of mostly correctly prescribed drugs occur in the U.S. every year. And a large part of the problem is simply because so many drugs are used and prescribed, and many patients receive multiple prescriptions at varying strengths, and some of which may counteract each other or cause more severe reactions when combined. So you have dosage errors, medication mix-up, and even giving the wrong medication to the wrong person are very, very common occurrences. Points out, two, avoidable infections. Hospital-acquired infections are alarmingly common, and sadly, Dr. Mercola says, they're often deadly. In the United States, more than 2 million people are affected by hospital-acquired infections each year, and a whopping 100,000 people die as a result. Now, think about that. That is amazing. That, you know, many people go into the hospital with things that they didn't have, and they come in the front door alive and okay, and they're wheeled out the back door in a body bag. And so here we find that hospital-acquired infections are very common, and not only that, they're very deadly. And in the United States alone, more than 2 million people are affected by hospital-acquired infections each year, and a full 100,000 people die as a result just from infections acquired in the hospital. He points out further, according to the 2011 Health Grades Hospital Quality in America report, An analysis of approximately 40 million Medicare patient records from 2007 through 2009, it's just 2 years, showed that 1 in 9 patients developed such hospital-acquired infections. So that means if you're one of every 9 patients that goes into the hospital, you or someone or one of those other 8 people are going to acquire a hospital or going to acquire an infection, possibly deadly. The third and final one we'll deal with on that issue that people tend to run into when they go into hospital is they leave with surgical souvenirs. And they point out that surgical tools or other objects are left inside of people after surgery far more often than you like to think, he says. He says further, quote, this is often the result of surgical staff failing to count or miscounting equipment during the procedure. He says unexpected pain, fever, and swelling after surgery are all indications that you could have a surgical tool or a piece of a tool still inside of you. Then he asks the question, just how often does this occur? One study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that about 1,500 Americans have objects left inside of them following surgery every year. So that's a full 1,500 people every year that have surgical instruments left inside of them every year. I think we have a call coming in. Hello?
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Hey, I'm listening to your show. I'm enjoying it.
Oh, thank you for calling. You have a question? You just wanted to make a comment?
Yeah, you know, I guess here's my thing. I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago, so I don't know if you covered this yet or not, but I'm reading a lot of info on flu and the flu shot, and it seems like it's back in the media again. And it drives me nuts to hear all the talk and trying to promote flu shots. I'm not a proponent of flu shots. I never had one. I don't recommend to my friends or family to get one. I just want to get your take on it. And if you would, try to kind of let the people out there know what's your take and what's going on with all this hyping of the flu.
Oh, yes. I don't advocate flu shots either. And I think in most cases, I was going to talk about that today, but we won't have time in detail. But in general, there's a very interesting article. You can go and you can find it at naturalnews.com. And we were going to deal with that article today. But there's an article that shows that children who get vaccines, including flu shots, and flu shots are basically, essentially, they're useless in general. And I agree with you that a lot of the promotion that we're hearing about in the media is really designed behind the scenes to some degree, directly and indirectly, to boost up the sales essentially of the pharmaceutical companies, to be honest. And we were talking earlier in the show about the benefits of staying healthy, of using what we call natural antibiotics, following what we call the laws of health, the 8 laws of health. And I agree with you in that respect that in most cases, if most people would take the time to find out even some of the things that they put in flu shots, and some children, I have an article on my website. There's some.
What is
children,
that?
It's Phase 3 Ministries, PHASE, the number 3 Ministries.com.
Okay, and, thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome. And when you there's an article, I have an article there, and it basically talks about how often children who've never been sick a day in their lives until they've gotten a vaccination, or many people die from the flu shot. And the fact of the matter is that we really the flu shot is essentially in many respects it's a scam. And you can also look at there's a couple other articles at naturalnews.com. There's an article there they just published that talks about some secret government documents. I didn't get a chance to read the article yet. Maybe I'll have an opportunity to read later on that shows that the flu shots are basically a hoax. And if you know, I remember, I think it was last year, the H1N1, year before last, whenever all of the bird flu and whatnot was going on, they had even doctors on television when they were asked, would you take the flu shot or would you give it to your children? They were like, no, I wouldn't. And so it's very important to understand that I'm not an advocate of the flu shot. I don't take it, and I just try and keep myself healthy, And I've only ever had the flu one time in my life, and when I did have it, I was running a lot. I wasn't really resting. I wasn't getting enough rest, and I treated it with natural remedies, and it was wrapped up relatively quickly. And so thank you for calling. Do you have any other?
I was just going to say that, you know, growing up as a kid, the flu really and truly never ever was an epidemic. You know, I don't remember as a kid growing up them being so adamant about people getting flu shots. I never got one as a kid, and now it seems like every year they're hyping and just promoting. I mean, the media, I'm sure it's pharmaceutical driven, just seem to be promoting it really heavy as if the flu year in, year out is life-threatening. There's a propaganda behind it, and I agree with exactly what you're saying, and I just kind of wanted to make sure that I wasn't going crazy over here. I think there's more to it than just that. So anyways, I do enjoy your show and what you're out there promoting, and keep up the good work, and I'll listen to the rest of your show.
Okay, and what's your name again? I'm sorry, I didn't get your name.
Yeah, I'm Sean. I'm calling
Sean,
from Dallas.
Okay, Sean, thanks for calling, and keep listening.
Have a good day.
Right. You too, bye-bye. And we're going to move now from this segment, and we're going to, instead of taking a break now, we're going to go ahead and move into our second segment, which is our healing food segment. And this segment, if you've not listened before, or if this is the first time you've listened, and this is the segment where we talk about we pick out a particular healing food or a group of healing foods, and we talk about the nutritional value of these foods, and why we should eat copiously of these foods. And if you've listened before, you've heard me talking about we should actually eat, the majority of our diet should be in harmony with the colors of the rainbow. And the closer we eat in line with the colors of the rainbow, the healthier we would be. And, of course, from a natural perspective. So the color, there's seven colors of the rainbow, and you can remember it by the acronym ROYGBIV. That's ROYGBIV. And it's red, orange, yellow, blue, indigo, and violet. So the colors of the rainbow. And so now when we talk about yellow squashes, which we'll be talking about here in our healing food section, yellow squash is actually a type of summer squash, and it grows all over the United States and is easily found at your local farmers markets, roadside vegetable stands, and as well as grocery stores. And yellow squash is actually rich in many nutritional benefits, and it can be used in a variety of dishes. A lot of times kids may not like it, but you can prepare squash in such a way that it can be very palatable. It can be used in stews, salads, soups, etc. Well, first of all, from a nutritional perspective, one cup of yellow squash contains about 36 calories. It's about 7 grams of carbohydrates. It has less than 1 gram of fat and a gram of protein. It also has no cholesterol. So it's very, very, just from the word go, it's a very, very beneficial, healthy, and nutritious food. And it's in line also with the colors of the rainbow, one of the colors of the rainbow. And then let's look at some of the vitamins. It's very vitamin rich. It is a very, very beneficial source of vitamin C. It's a very good source of magnesium, very good source of vitamin A, particularly in its concentrations of carotenoids, including beta carotene, which when you eat beta carotene in vegetables, especially in carrots or squash, the liver converts the beta carotene to vitamin A. And we're going to be talking about, if we have time today, we're going to talk about in our final section, we're talking about the vitamins, and we've been talking about the nutrients in the body and how they're used. We'll be talking about vitamin A. And if we don't have time to talk about vitamin A, we'll talk about it next week on the show. But we'll talk about how beneficial it is, how to recognize deficiencies, and how much we need to take. And now back to squash. Squash is also abundant in potassium. And potassium is very, 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 very important. Squash provides about 345.60 milligrams per serving. And again, potassium, of course, is an electrolyte. in the balance of the fluid, and it also provides muscle energy. And you've heard me talk about here on the show before the importance of our pH balance. If you're in the body wants to be just a little bit more alkaline, about 7.35 blood pH, then acid. Consistent alkalinity in the system, the blood and the fluids of the body, pretty much reflects our good health. Consistent acidity is going to consume your buffering minerals, one of which those buffering minerals being potassium. And once those buffering minerals are not there, they're what keep the buffer or keep the alkalinity of the system. Once they're consumed and you become deficient in them, your pH is going to be thrown off. And one of the good foods to help prevent that, because it has potassium as well as some of the other minerals and vitamins that we need, is the food that we're talking about, the healing food that we're talking about today, being yellow squash. In addition to those other things, it also is high in manganese. It also which helps the body process fats and carbohydrates as well as glucose. Yellow squash is also abundant in different antioxidants that keep the free radicals that go throughout the body and cause damage at bay. Because it's high in beta carotene content, it's also antioxidant. It's also as I said earlier, it's very high in vitamin C, and this helps to prevent premature aging. It's also helps to stave off cancer. It also can be beneficial. Squash can also be beneficial for your heart health. As I said earlier, it has no cholesterol. And one cup of squash contains about 0.2 grams of fat. And so it helps with if you're a person that has high cholesterol, not only eating squash, but eating a variety of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and grains. And, of course, exercising and drinking plenty of water and getting plenty of rest, those 8 laws of health that we talked about, they can actually greatly, greatly benefit you. The magnesium found in yellow squash, now get this, the magnesium found in yellow squash has actually been shown to reduce the risk of heart attack as well as stroke. So eating squash is going to, the creator has put magnesium within the squash, as Hippocrates said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be food. So we have squashes is high in various nutrients and minerals. As I said earlier, the magnesium found in yellow squash has been shown to reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. And along with this potassium content, magnesium is also good for reducing high blood pressure. Again, so you have the high blood pressure, it can be beneficial for it. It's beneficial because it doesn't elevate your cholesterol levels. It's good as an antioxidant, natural antioxidants like vitamin C. Also, it's very, very beneficial for the magnesium content, etc. Now, it also has folate in it, which is also beneficial, as we talked about last week. We were talking about folic acid, which is converted to folate in the body, and it helps in a myriad of ways. And because we're running out of time here, let me keep moving. I won't go into the details, but it's also beneficial because of the abundant fiber content. It helps your colon health because it helps keep things moving through your colon. You don't want things to sit there, and so the fruits and vegetables, because they have fiber, and also yellow squash has fiber, is beneficial for your colon health. It's also beneficial for prostate health. Yellow squash has been shown to alleviate the symptoms of a condition named benign prostate hypertrophy, which is a BPH. And so men who suffer with BPH can have problems with urination, and they can also have problems with their sexual function. Because of it, also yellow squash is, because of its particularly high levels of beta carotene and lutein, it's very, very beneficial for your eyes. It can even help prevent the onset of cataracts and as well as macular degeneration, often leads to blindness. And so one cup of yellow squash actually provides about 135 micrograms of beta carotene and about 2,400 micrograms of lutein, which is also an eye nutrient. It's also beneficial for your bones. Because I said earlier, because of the other nutrients that it contains, it's also beneficial for help maintaining your healthy bone structure, because it also helps with calcium absorption, enzyme creation, as well as bone building. It also contributes to the mineral density of the spinal column. So here the creator has packed all sorts of nutrients in a load food such as yellow squash. And it is amazing, as we look at the nutrient content of these foods, when we look at the nutrient content, content of some of the food that we've talked about on here, and we can understand why if we eat healthy, since we were talking earlier about the flu, as we were talking about the herb we were talking about earlier, black elderberry, we were talking about why it was so effective in fighting off the flu. We find that many of the same nutrients that are found in these herbs to help keep us healthy and to fight off these diseases and sicknesses are the same ones that are found in foods. And so it's just a matter of eating a healthy diet overall, dealing with our stress levels, trusting in the Creator, getting plenty of exercise, drinking plenty of water. These things, they may be simple, but they're deceptively effective. And many times we don't realize it because of their simplicity, because we've been so educated to take medications, to take drug medications, instead of to eat healthy, to do those things that we need to do to stay out of harm's way. Now, we won't finish, but next week we'll cut a little time out of our first segment and make up for that time in this final segment, which is the healing herb, healing supplement segment, and where we go in and we talk about a particular herb or vitamin or some other mineral, some other nutrient, and talk about the recommended daily allowances, the therapeutic amounts that you would need. And it's a very good idea to understand that if you have all of these nutrients in your body, it's very, very difficult for you to get sick. But long-term deficiencies of these nutrients, I can say with certainty that you will get sick. And so we've been going through, in recent weeks, we've actually been going through some of the vitamins. And today we're going to go into vitamin A. I will tell you this about vitamin A, that the recommended daily allowance is about 5,000 international units. The optimal daily amount is also about 5,000 international units. If you need it on therapeutic levels, however, you can need as much as 20 to 30,000 international units a day for a while. And it's best to take it, vitamin A, only in the form of beta-carotene, which is the vegetable source precursor of vitamin A, is why I was saying earlier that if you take beta-carotene, like when squash has beta-carotene, or if you take carrot juice has beta-carotene, when you take it, the liver will convert the beta-carotene to vitamin A, because you do need vitamin A, but you need it in the fashion that the body converts it over from beta-carotene and not so much from taking vitamin A in a supplement form. And so we'll be talking more about vitamin A next week. We plan to talk more about it next week. We'll talk about how much to take in case of viral infections, how much to take in case of therapeutic amounts. We'll talk about how to recognize if in fact you are deficient, because prolonged deficiency of vitamin A can cause colds and some other issues. And we'll talk about the amounts that you need to take. We'll talk about how to identify deficiencies, etc. We're down to about a minute left in the show. We thank you for listening. Next week, we plan to be back with another show. We'll follow the same format. Of course, if you have questions or comments you'd like to do, you can do so as Sean did. We thank you for calling, Sean. Again, to all of my listeners throughout the U.S. and throughout the world, thank you for listening. If you want more information, you can visit the blog. You can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/naturedoc, or you can follow me on Twitter at Blue Zone Wellness. Until next week, thank you for listening, and may God bless and keep you. Next week, same time, same place, 4 to 5 p.m. Have a blessed evening.